Howard Lindzen is the founder and general partner at Social Leverage. All opinions expressed by Howard and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of Social Leverage or StockTwits. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon for decisions. Guests may maintain positions and securities discussed in this podcast.
K, not
Howie.
NK, Nikita.
Hi, guys.
Hey.
The three amigos. Here we are. Just remember, it's my show. I already see Nikita asking you a lot of questions about how to do this in case something happened to me. I don't even know how that conversation came up. All of a sudden, if Howard were to go disappearing, ooh. I thought that was inappropriate. I overheard that.
We were just accounting for the key man risk.
Yeah. Is there insurance? Podcast insurance?
Oh, yeah. We're fully covered.
Today, we're going to get right into it because it's a subject near and dear to me. I collect watches. Very few people know about it. But now everybody knows about it. It's a guy thing. Nikita, you have an Apple Watch. Do you love your Apple? Oh, and are you wearing a Whoop too?
No.
Do you love your Apple Watch?
I love it. But
what's your main thing that you use it for?
Just for workouts.
Okay. So yeah. You track your steps?
Yeah. So I track my steps for my bike rides, for my workouts, the strength training. Like, it's all on here. So I really like it.
Hmm. Canoon?
I'm a Rolex and Skagen guy.
What's Skagen?
It's a Danish brand. It's super slim. It's beautiful.
Hmm. What are the Danes known? Well, I mean, they're known for beautiful design of right. Furniture.
Oh, yeah. They do it on everything else as well.
Yeah, we'll see if he knows what Skagenheim is. I've heard of Guggenheim, but not Skagenheim.
But as a girl, I mean, I read once that Prof Galloway, he said that if you're a single girl and you're looking for like a guy, you should basically check what watch he's wearing.
I agree. But looking to judge him or looking to see if you want to buy him a gift or looking to see if he's cool?
Well, he said that depending on what watch he's wearing, that can tell you if he'll be able to look after you.
So what am I signaling? I have a used Rolex. What does that signal?
That you can look after a girl.
But maybe not. It's used. And it says R-O-L-E-K. Rolex. With an S. It's the Russian version. Yeah. Like Alex. All right. So today we have on my friend Justin from Watchbox. He founded Watchbox here in the U.S. He's lived overseas in London. He's been all over the world. He's built this. I didn't know this because I've invested in, it did not work out. One of our VC investments, a company called Truefacet. So in talking to Justin over the last few months, I've learned a lot more about the online jewelry business and watch business, and they have a very high average sales price. So it's a really interesting business that they've built, mostly digital, but partly physical. But they're the world's leading platform for the buying, selling, and trading of pre-owned luxury watches. They got a hybrid high-tech meets high-touch model, and we'll talk about that. And I think that's genius. As the world, obviously the last year's tough, but I think post-COVID that becomes a big thing again, pop-ups and meeting people and like that trust part of this high-end, whether you're selling anything high-end, you've got to be able to have a way to build trust in the physical world. So they employ a hybrid, high-tech, high-touch model to provide, you know, quality control process and guarantee the authenticity and condition of all watches bought and sold. So this subject near and dear to me, as you said, I guess women are eyeing that part because every guy has the same iPhone. They wear Lululemon. They wear a baseball cap, maybe sunglasses, watch. Used to be shoes. You could tell a guy, but it should. No guy wears dress shoes, I don't think. Maybe Justin does. People in London, I still think, do because everybody there has bad teeth, bad toes. And... right? Like, it's important. We'll ask Justin about that. Like, they have to wear wingtip shoes, and they never smile because they're worried that they'll be judged by their teeth. So anyway, so Justin's back in Philly now with the whole team, and I just want to talk about the massive size of this market. We've talked about inflation endlessly. There's massive inflation. Fascinated by Rolexes because I have, I don't know, 50 watches over the last 30 years that I've collected, and they sit in a safety deposit box. And for some reason, through COVID, I've just worn this used Rolex the whole time. And it really is still comfortable, versatile watch that incredibly holds value. Like you said, Rolex right away.
Well, I've owned it since
I don't know how they've done it. He'll talk to us a little about that. Much like De Beers with diamonds. I think that's how you pronounce it. How do you would know. How do you pronounce De Beers?
No, you pronounce it right, De Beers.
Yeah, De Beers.
But yeah. Even on it, like you mean for yourself?
Mm-hmm.
Like with diamonds?
No. I'm just saying diamonds have this cabal. Yeah, I have one in my belly button and on my left nipple. You got one in your tooth?
No, you do.
No, I don't have one. I was thinking of covering up the mole with a diamond, just a stud right inside my nose.
Did they cover that up?
Oh. This has gone beyond just planning, I think. You guys are forming a coup. Quit having such a good time at my expense. So let's bring Justin on. We're going to talk about pricing, how this whole service works, the type of customer. It's much like trading. Watchbox has gone after the male audience. Obviously, there's a lot of female sites for buying jewelry online, but this is a male-dominated business. And for the women that listen to me, understand guys love this stuff. And you can afford to do this. It's not something you can just randomly buy. Guys are pretty particular about their watches. So let's get Justin on the phone.
You got it.
Justin.
Hello, Howard.
Hey, you've got Howard, Nikita, Canute. You don't even have to acknowledge them, though, unless they say something super smart.
Hi, Nikita. Hi, Canute. Nice to meet you guys.
Very nice to meet you, too.
Hi, Justin.
So you've met a lot of my friends, but we haven't met just over Zoom because of COVID. When did you move to Philly? You're in Philly now.
I moved here early 2020. I came just before the storm of COVID and Black Lives Matter. So it was really my induction to baptism of fire, taking on the CEO role here.
And what were you doing before you took on the CEO role?
Well, Watchbox, the company I co-founded, we ran it remotely. We had a management team over here in the United States, which is where our headquarters are. But I was still based in Singapore and Hong Kong, building out our Asian operation. So I was running the business from 2017 from Asia, but we had a management team over here. And only recently did I just come over early last year to come over and take over as CEO. So it was definitely new for me. And moving from Asia into, these capital cities to the suburbs of Philadelphia was definitely a step change for me.
But when did you get first into watches?
I got first into watches probably back in 2006. A very close friend of mine had a watch business, which he was looking to sell. And it was one of the largest watch retailers in Asia. My previous life, I was finance and ran my own private equity fund. And he was looking to sell a publicly traded company, which was distributing a lot of the large Swiss known brands into North and Southeast Asia. And that's where I got to learn about the business, learn the industry. And when I went to go due diligence the company and the brands in Switzerland, that's kind of where I got into the trade.
Do you remember the first watch that you bought that was like signify that you had spent real money on a watch?
Yeah, I do. I have a twin brother, and when we were at university in the UK, I was in. It actually sounds a little sentimental, but it's true. I was in London, and I was graduating from LSE, and he was in Nottingham. And we used to spend our times during the weekends going around, watching movies and doing what most students do. But we'd always be looking at watches and saying, "Oh, one day we'll get a watch." And I wanted to buy. I was always thinking about which watch I would get first. And when I started my career as a bond trader, the first bonus I got when I was working, I got my brother a Rolex. It was an Explorer 1, which is that smallish dial with a black color face.
Yep.
And I gave that to him. That was my first watch.
You gave it to him?
Yeah.
That's twin brother. My wife's a twin, and they don't buy each other anything. So that's a very nice gift. Did he keep it, or has he traded it?
He kept it, but I figured I might as well pay it forward. I figured I might as well hedge my bets in case he's more successful than I am.
Well, I'll get into it right away. What is it about a brand that markets everywhere that seems to have watches in every jewelry, high-end jewelry store? How have they been able to just, because millennials today, that's the first thing they go buy, it seems like, a watch. And a Rolex is what I'm hearing, like whether you talk to Salesforce, you talk to some of these enterprise companies that I recruit for and whatever, and the bosses will tell me these kids have watches, like five or six of them. So what is it that makes them want to buy a watch now over a stock or crypto? Like, what is it about, and specifically Rolex?
Well, I mean, it's a great question, and I think you'll hear multiple different answers around this, but my view is that these are brands that have been around for the longest periods of time. They've built such enormous value in their brand equity just because of, by nature of their business model, you know, they produce goods, you know, in the factories in Switzerland, and they command a very, you know, a steep price, and obviously, you know, command a relatively high gross margin in their own business. And their number one commodity is their brand. So, you know, as you and I may be trading Facebook or Google, you know, Watchbox trades in the best brand equities in the world because their marketing advertising budgets are so strong. And what they've trained the consumer to understand and believe that, you know, watches, they're built, these are mechanical instruments that are built to last 100 years. And no one ever throws out a Rolex. You know, we may throw out or destroy or scrap our old Mercedes, but you never ever throw out a Rolex. And I think that's something that's from the customer's psychology, that this has always been, especially for men, there's very few things that we can spend money on today. You know, we could probably debate the fourth W, but it's wheels, wine, and watches. Mm-hmm. And
what's the fourth W?
Wives.
I was going to say weirdos. Wives didn't even, no offense, 26 years, wives was not in my top 10 W's. And wine, no interest to me. I still will never, ever get wine. Ever in 1,000 years. I'm glad you're not in that business. But all right, so wine, watches, what was the third? Oh, wheels. Good one.
Wheels, yeah.
Okay.
And insofar as, you know, the female category, you know, Nikita, you have so many choices of what you can spend money on today. It could be handbags, it could be jewelry, it could be bracelets, earrings, you name it. There's so many things that women can purchase and collect. But for men, you know, we don't really collect jewelry. And in some shape or form, you know, watches does fulfill part of that space. So today, I think, you know, why Rolex is so prevalent. I mean, they've obviously built a very strong brand. It's synonymous with value. And the brand themselves has been very good at increasing the price of a Rolex over time. If you track Rolex prices over the last 30 years, you'll see a continuous rise in what, you know, how you'd call like the bond floor of what the intrinsic value of that watch would be worth. And as that continues to grow, that's just built enormous consumer confidence. And when we started this business, I wanted to test the liquidity in the market. Now, if I gave you a handbag or a Rolex and I said, Howard, run away for 30 minutes and see if you can bring any value back from this, bring me cash, you could go run down the street on 47th Street and you'd be able to cash in that Rolex for value. And I think that's what the customer really understands today, is that this brand is almost as good as cash. And, you know, you'll hear, you know, our previous generations always talk about Rolex as something that it'll never go down in value. And I think that's permeated to the consumer. And today, there's a variety of collectible reasons why Rolex is still doing incredibly well. But I think the underlying theme is that it's got a store of value and it's not going to go away. And that's where Rolex has done so well today.
In terms of counterfeit, because I have one and I just trusted the person that I bought it from, but is it weight? Is there something that gives it away that it's a Rolex in a world where it'd be so, if it's cash, obviously counterfeiting would matter. So what is it about a Rolex that just people know?
We have an authentication center. So a watch that you buy will be authenticated and it'll go through what we call a 21-point check system. And there are so many things aside from the weight, the shape of the bracelet, especially where the logo is, you know, it's got this little three-pointed crown, where it's placed, the typography of the Rolex logo itself in the inner bezel. There's so many things that go into each different model reference and intelligence that one is able to check to see if it's authentic. The number of pirated watches that have been developed, you know, there's just been incredible amounts that have been produced.
That's what I'm saying. I got to assume that unless you're going to a watch box or a really trusted source, there's just too many ways to counterfeit.
It's funny. Like, I was living in Asia for almost 30 years, and what we found, there was so much around, but the quality, whilst it's very good across multiple brands, you know, there are the telltale signs that you can check to see. At Watchbox, we may get, over the last 2 years, 3 counterfeit watches that would come into our system that we wouldn't purchase, but our operations team will find them. And people will know because we're constantly broadcasting how we check the inventory. It's just given us a huge amount of firewall to prevent people trying to trick the system. But there are a lot of counterfeit watches out there today. And I mean, especially from the countries that you'd imagine they'd made. But the brands themselves have been able to crack down the distribution of, you know, many of these counterfeits over time.
And so tell me the size of, like, what can you tell me about Watchbox? It's a It's a massive, I mean, this is a world of fragmented, I mean, there's a huge market, so it's highly fragmented. So how do you think about Watchbox?
So the business itself was founded on the principle that you've got this massive addressable market of watches that have been produced out of Switzerland each year.
20 billion?
So 40 to 50 billion of retail value comes out each year. So it's like the issuance that comes into the market.
Does that include Apple and Timex, or is that high end?
It's excluding the digital watches, but you know, by and large, it's the high value pieces.
Okay.
So we're looking at, you know, if you extrapolate, you know, back 15 years, you're looking at $750 billion of watches that are sitting in the drawers of all the customers, you know, globally, and that inventory is just sitting out there, and a very small proportion of that's trading each year. When we started the company in 2017, the size of the market was somewhere around $3 billion. Fast forward to today, we believe there's about 20 billion of watches pre-owned that are trading in the market. And these are by and large trading from dealer to dealer. I mean, there's a very small portion of the market today, which is B2C. It's just there's a lot more liquidity in the market. There's a lot more actors and players that are trading it and having these very small mom and pop style platforms, which may sell $1 to $2 million of inventory. And so in terms of the size of the market, it's grown considerably, actually far greater than what the luxury market on the primary side has grown. Our business is formed here in the US. We're 160 people today. The company was really born on the premise of creating a trusted platform, as you said, Howard. I kind of like to think of it back to my finance days, like we're the JP Morgan of trading for high-priced luxury goods. And we wanted to build a platform which was focused on key principles of trust. We believe that if we could offer a service to consumers which was frictionless and made it really easy for you to buy, sell, and trade a watch on the spot, where we could write the check and you didn't have to worry about listing it on a marketplace or consigning the watch, but you just, when you wanted to sell the Rolex on your wrist, we could just write the check and you could trade it for another watch. And so we built the business where we started off in Philadelphia, which is where our headquarters are. And we slowly, as we built the business and then invested in technology and capital into inventory, we slowly open up offices around the world. Today, we have offices in Philadelphia, Hong Kong, Dubai, Switzerland, and Singapore. And we're soon to open another 4 to 5 offices around the world. And we believe that by opening up offices, we're able to activate markets. So when you and I first met, one of the things we spoke about was, you know, we were drawing parallels between our business and Carvana. And Carvana is an inventory-based model, owning inventory to provide, you know, high-quality inventory to their consumer. And we're very much the same. You know, we own our inventory and we turn it as frequently as possible. But we build our version of the Carvana vending machines into markets where there's communities, where we can activate them and bring them onto our platform. And each office can collect, drop off, buy, sell, and trade watches and plug it into our system.
That is amazing. So is Rolex the biggest brand in the space?
Rolex is definitely the biggest brand in our space. It represents in the industry about 40 to 50% of the high value portion of the market.
Wow.
They produce close to 1 million watches a year, and their price point varies between 8,000 and 15,000.
Retail?
Pretty much.
Oh.
At retail, yes.
Oh, so even like the gold, but what's the highest end, like that gold bracelet one, which I can't wear, like, I don't know how people wear it, but like that's the ultimate status?
Yeah, there's a gold, what they call the rainbow. It's the gold, rose gold bracelet with it's got like a diamond dial on the, which is multicolored. And that watch is the most expensive piece they sell.
I like the Submariner, the Rolex Submariner.
Is that what I have? No. So the Submariner, is that the most popular right now, the Submariner?
It's quite pricey.
Yes.
So is that the one that's in demand right now?
That's probably the most popular and well-known iconic Rolex that's out there. The Submariner, you know, it retails probably for around $9,000 in the market. It trades, you know, in the mid-teens. But it's definitely one of the most iconic pieces that Rolex produces.
And then what is the brand? I don't find them attractive watches, Patek Philippe. So what is it about that brand that people love? Yeah, I don't know. Like, I wouldn't get one. If someone gave it to me, I would trade it for something else. So I don't find them modern. I don't like the shape. Like, it's all about how it looks to you. But what is it about that brand?
It's beauty, you know, is in the eye of the beholder, but it's a very, very successful brand. Probably, you know, it would be ranking consistently number two in terms of size. I mean, they produce, I think, close to 60,000 watches a year, and their price point is significantly higher than when Rolex is. But the brand is just being really, you know, well regarded as a, also a store of value. They're probably more in the collectible space than Rolex is in terms of the very, very high end. They produce very complicated timepieces. So they have timepieces that would sell at retail close to 1.2 million. There's even one piece that sells for 2 million. And you'll see them appear in auction frequently. But they've gone after a different market, but it's been a family-owned business. And you recognize their advertising campaigns that you never own a Patek Philippe. You merely own it for the next generation. So they really embody this idea that this is like a family heirloom product. And then, you know, at least with the Watchbox, when you bring it to us, the children like to trade it.
Yeah, my favorite scene ever in a movie, Albert Brooks, I forget what it's like, where he's dead, and they're talking about, they go back in his life and talk about all the mistakes he's made in his life. And one of them is like an investment they could have made in Casio. And he's like, dude, you know, the Swiss keep time, not, you know, I don't know if you've seen that. It's Albert Brooks is funny, but like it was one of the great movie ideas where they just went back through his life and showed him how all the fuck ups he made. And his Japanese friend came to pitch him Casio. And he's like, you fucking idiot, the Swiss keep time, not the Japanese. And, and they go through what that investment would have been worth. Why is it the Swiss that keep value? What is it about the Swiss and time? Is there an answer?
No, I wouldn't be able to comment on that one. It's always been profiled as a cottage industry that, you know, it's far and remote, and they've got this long tradition of, you know, hand-making watches, and they're the very best at it. But in terms of them versus the Japanese, I wouldn't be able to...
versus the Japanese, but when we think of timepieces that keep value, we think of Swiss watches, right? Is Patek not a Swiss company?
Yes, it is. Yeah, Swiss.
And so let's walk through a Watchbox customer. You've made it and you want to watch. So tell me, they're hearing about Watchbox here. What's the use case? So what do people do? And what's the typical customer look like on Watchbox?
So there's two user flows. One is whether you're going to buy a watch or you're going to sell a watch. There's a variety of ways in which you can touch Watchbox. You know, we have an app and we have our website, and the customer comes in, they can search through our inventory, they can watch our videos. We have a very large media section of our business where we produce almost CNBC style shows every day so that customers can learn about inventory, watch our market wrap show. It's a little bit like Jim Cramer, and we're talking about what's been trading in the market. We do 30, 40 videos a week, and we're talking about watch reviews. And so the customer comes in and is able to touch the content. They'll come through any one of our channels and, you know, make a lead where they're looking for a timepiece. Either they look through the watches that we own, or we will find them the watch that they're looking for. And it's really that simple. And we have built our business very much like a bank, where we have a sales and trading team and a client advisory team. And very few of our transactions are actually click and buy. We actually promote the platform so you can actually speak to a client advisor. And that's probably where we differentiate from many other e-commerce companies. And that's been able to allow us to build trust and drive repeat transactions. So once you've found the watch you're looking for, we'll send it out to you once we've received funds, and it will be with you within 24 hours. On the flip side of the transaction, if someone wants to sell us a watch, and this is something that, you know, we buy from consumer and we sell to consumer. So if Nikita wanted to sell her Patek Philippe 24, she would send us a photo of it and we would give her a price instantaneously. We have a pricing machine that's internal, almost like a Bloomberg pricing machine, where we'll generate a price based on historical data, and we'll share the price with Nikita. If she agrees to that price, we'll send her a shipping label, and once we receive the watch, you know, the next day, we'll send her the funds to her account. So it's a very quick transaction.
Now, say her boyfriend bought her this watch. What would she need to include with that watch? So she doesn't have the box or proof or whatever. No, I'm wondering how this works because, but who's taking the risk that you've got? Obviously, you've agreed on a price from the Bloomberg data, and you guys have an eye for doing this, but things change. Like, the watch gets shipped to you, and you realize...
It's fully insured, and when the watch arrives, I mean, we don't pay for the watch until we've actually received it, and it's been gone through an intake process. And as you can imagine, we have a FedEx truck that turns up every day, and there's hundreds of watches which are being offloaded. Amazing. And as the watches come through, you know, and they come in all shapes and sizes. I mean, you'd be surprised how what people keep their boxes in, and they'll put in an $80,000 watch in a sock and in a Nike box, and they'll send it in.
Wait a minute, that's how I do it. So why is it a bad? Who was going to look at my socks?
That's
my
your safety
watches?
Deposit box?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Well, who's going to touch Howard's socks?
Especially the dirty ones. Right?
Yeah. Yeah, leave extra toenails around them. It's kind of like, oh, people reach in and go, what just happened? And then they leave the Rolex alone. So is there a U.S. drop-off or does that all go through Europe?
It's you can send the watch into any of our offices around the world. And so imagine that people are, you know, when they're selling watches, they're coming in every day. Today, for example, we had about 15 watches arrive in our Dubai office. And immediately, four of them sold in Switzerland. So immediately, they come in and then they take off and they fly on their way to Switzerland to be sold. So that I think of them as little mini airplanes. They're coming in five different airports, and you know, we keep inventory globally, so it doesn't just sit in one location. It's actually floating, and so we're able to pull through our inventory management system watches from any location and send them to another location.
Yeah, I mean, what's fascinating, the vision is you built this whole exchange out, obviously. This is not something you can just randomly create a Shopify website and make this stuff happen. This is an intricate market that they've designed, which is why I wanted to have you on here. So what is it?
Well, go ahead, Nikita. I'm just so fascinated because, you know, I think I read somewhere last year that Apple sold more iWatches in 2020 than all the Swiss brands combined. And so I kind of was thinking as a millennial that, oh, of course, you know, I wear my Apple Watch and it looks pretty good. So
it looks great. I mean, so, but it seems like women wear it more than men though.
True. Really?
Yeah. And like, say your boyfriend bought you a Rolex, would you still wear the iPhone every day? I mean, would you wear your iPhone on your thing and talk into it like you're in space?
Well, see, that's the thing, right? I think I would use it for a date night thing, but on a daily basis, I would still continue to wear my Apple Watch.
Yeah. I'm wondering if men do that if they have the choice. What do you think, Justin? No? Yes?
I think we've seen a lot more change. You know, there was a cycle where everyone wanted to wear an Apple Watch. And I think what we've even noticed with our customer demographic, there's this consumer that wants identity. And, you know, the values that they see in an Audemars Piguet or a Rolex or a Resonance watch, you know, kind of reflects their interest. And so I think whilst everyone has an Apple Watch, you know, many people that work in my company are wearing an Apple Watch on one hand and they're wearing a Swiss watch on the other hand.
That I haven't seen.
It's interesting.
Is that a turn off, Nikita? The guy has three watches. What would be the number where you just like a pass? If you see a guy on Tinder, he's wearing two watches. Is that cool?
No.
Okay. I think Apple Watches have been great for watches in general. Don't you think? Like they've just, because if everybody's wearing the same watch, just like iPhones have created all kinds of this collectible world where if everybody's got the same product, they even feel more inclined to go out on the spectrum and speculate and own something even more different than everybody else. So I think having an iPhone watch or iPhone, an Apple Watch has actually helped the watch business. Do you think that's showing up in your numbers?
Yeah, I think so. I think we're seeing, you know, the customer's buying behavior hasn't changed so drastically where they don't seek individuality and they're looking for brands to collect. And I think more recently in the last 2 to 3 years, this whole notion of collectability and looking at other assets, whether it be sports memorabilia, cars or handbags, you know, people are seeing, you know, because it's so easy to understand brands and the structured data behind collecting and price tracking, it lends itself, all the qualities of what you see in the watch market is creating customers that want to collect, you know, driving them to collect watches.
Does Watchbox get is insurance an ancillary business idea?
We haven't launched it today. The margins in insurance are really, really tight. And it's something that as in a service that we could add on to the customer, it's definitely something we're exploring. Other players have brought insurance into their portfolio. But it's, you know, it's a product that generates almost 1% potentially if we added it on. So it's not a huge add-on.
I don't have insurance, so that's a tip to anybody trying to rob me. You'd really mess with my head. But
I think matchmaking is a better ancillary idea for Watchbox. Think about
if
it.
If you, the women that like men that wear this watch?
Yeah, what like, mean? I mean, Watchbox could just have it implicitly. Like they don't have to. It just
a lot
be
of
like,
sites could do that.
Yeah, but like
Zillow could do that. You're looking at $30 million home. Meet the guys that own them.
But they could introduce it more subtly. They'd be like, oh, we know this person who has similar interest in these watches. So therefore, we're going to pair you up.
Yeah. What do you think?
That's actually not a bad idea. I think, Nikita, if you send us a photograph We'll put you on our next email campaign and test it out.
Yeah. Well, Nikita would get overflowed with stuff. She'd heard people be sliding into her DMs all day. So what is the odds? Like, I don't have insurance. Am I crazy on a 6 or 10? Like, are you crazy not to have insurance?
I think household insurance, you know, is what we've seen most of our guys have. But, you know, my concern more would be about the appreciating value of the watches, because you want the replacement value insured. And that's probably something that we're seeing such a huge move recently in pricing, that if it's not covered correctly, you'd be exposed.
Got it. Now, the hybrid part of yours is what excites me the most as an investor and someone who's passionate about watches. I don't like going to a jeweler. Jewelry has always been like a women's kind of thing, whether it's stocks or watches, or I guess cigars, or booze. It's a guy thing. So where'd you come up with the physical idea and the hybrid model?
I think the whole idea about building this omni-channel strategy was we needed to give them the ability to build trust. You know, opening up physical locations, think of them like almost like mini Soho houses around the world, where you can come in and meet the client advisor and build that relationship. You know, living in Asia, we had to open this omni-channel, you know, hybrid, where you could go online and offline. Customers aren't used to putting a $50,000 watch in a FedEx pouch and hopefully it makes its destination in Asia. So we really needed to build that trust by opening in locations which, ordinarily you wouldn't see a watch dealer. For example, in Hong Kong, we're right in central next to the Mandarin Hotel.
Really? I've been there so many times, but I've never... How long have you guys been there?
We've been there for 3 years.
Oh, well, maybe I haven't been. I'm glad I didn't discover that. That'd be expensive to discover you 3 years ago. I'm kind of bummed I discovered you now. It's just amazing how big you guys are and how little I knew about this industry, but the physical is so important to me.
Yeah. I mean, when we moved over here to Philadelphia, I mean, Warby Parker was just getting going. And, you know, I don't like to think that businesses should try and replicate other business models and use it as the leading, you know, strategy for them. But what Warby did very, very well was they really went out and opened that human touch element to convey their brand and share their values. And, you know, I do see that as an ongoing strategy for us, where we will, you know, open up, where we have plans to open up in London next. And, you know, our idea is to open up a location in central Mayfair and Berkeley Square and make it really accessible to open to that community.
Yeah, you don't want to be in a strip mall. You want to be like in Soho or Soho in London, right? In an area where it's like international, you know, people are traveling and they see the brand and they go, yeah, it's not going to be 10 locations in a city. It's like you only really need one location in a city.
Absolutely. And then that's where there's a great opportunity. It's not a question about if, it's really those communities already exist.
Yep.
You know, we know from our data where our customers are. And, you know, even if we open up in Scandinavia, you know, in Oslo or in
Amsterdam.
Amsterdam. And the model itself for selling watches has just changed so much. You've got this traditional retail model where you have companies like Tourneau and Watches of Switzerland who are really, you know, tied to the brands. They have a lot of rules attached to them where they have to sell inventory through their brick and mortar store and usually very high cost retail locations with a lot of staff sitting behind the counter waiting for the customer to come in. And the great thing about Watchbox and the pre-owned market is there aren't any rules. I mean, it's really a market where you can sell a watch anywhere around the world at the price that you choose to command. And that's giving us the passport to really move to these emerging markets and open up locations and really connect them quickly and grow that network effect. And I think that's one of the things that really excites me about what we're doing is, you know, this year will be somewhere between 250 and 300 million in revenue. But there's an opportunity to grow this business to close to $1 billion in a relatively short period of time, just because there's these markets that haven't been able to connect to a central network.
I read in a report that 75% of the secondhand sales in the hard luxury market are in watches.
Well, I think it's because he says no one throws out a watch. So it's right. Always cash at some level. What's most intriguing to me, and this is selfish, three brands stand out to me. And I have to say, like, forgetting Rolex for a minute, because I can't believe I'm wearing one with the watches that I have. And it just, I don't know, it just does the job for me of sending out whatever signal I'm supposed to be sending out, a la Professor Galloway. Obviously, it's sex or something.
I think Ellen got the signal.
No. Her signal was, okay, as long as you bought it used, that's fine with me. So she's the cheap twin. So my question is, three brands blow my mind. The most important brand, because I think it's word of mouth and fucking elegant, is Resonance. Am I pronouncing it right? Because I have a couple.
Yes, that's correct. Resonance, yeah.
Resonance. And the design, everything about it, how they built a brand by word of mouth and Instagram, like, it blows my mind. What do we know about this brand? Where are they from? And, like, is it a watch that's interesting to you? Or are you seeing traction in the watch?
It's definitely something unique, Howard. I mean, I remember when I met you first, I think you were wearing one. And they produce a couple hundred pieces a year. The founder, Benoit, is actually from Belgium, if I'm not mistaken, and the watches are produced over there. Mm-hmm. You know, it's one of the few watches which has this, you know, incredible oil reservoir inside the watch, which allows the movements to turn. And, you know, this is so distinguishable. For those that know, know. And it's definitely one of those watches that, you know, if you look from afar, you'll know what that watch is about. They've got different models, and but they've stayed true to their, you know, the values and the look and feel. You know, many of these watch brands that haven't been successful, they've gone into too many different, you know, they try to be a brand too many and, you know, everyone's interest. You know, I think Resonance is just one of those iconic brands. I think...
yeah, look it up on Instagram.
I'm Googling it right now.
It's just a beautifully designed, you wouldn't know unless you know. So my story on Resonance, or whatever the fuck we're going to call it, recency, whatever this...
Raisins.
The Raisins brand is that Mickey Malka, who won't come on this show, is a great venture capitalist, Ariba Capital. I was in his office one day, and he wears jeans and a t-shirt like me, and we're having a meeting, and he's wearing this watch, and I'm like, fucking... The whole meeting, I was just like staring at his watch, and at the end of the meeting, I go, what the hell is that? And he goes, don't worry, you can't afford it. And that was what a great marketing was. I go, what the fuck? I looked at Tom after him, and I go, what does he mean by that? Like, I'm an investor in Robinhood. And that sent me down the rabbit hole of looking it up and going, oh, he was right. I can't afford it. And that made it easy for me to, like, just forget about it until we sold some Robinhood shares, and then I immediately got one. Send him a picture of it with me wearing it. And he goes, ah, congrats. So what great marketing that that's how that watch is spread. Do they do any kind of formal marketing? And then now that I've worn the watch, Justin, whoever I see, if I'm wearing the oil watch at a meeting, someone will go, where'd you get it? I go, where you can't afford it. And it's spread. And like 10 friends have now, I have no referral fee. 10 people have bought that watch. So I think that's fascinating, right? That does not happen with the Rolex.
Yeah, you don't. It's such a iconic piece, that Resonance piece. I mean, it's nice to see, you know, an emergent small brand that really cares and loves not to commercialize their brand, you know, overly. You know, these guys are really great. And, you know, the guy that's the CEO, and actually, Howard, I'll organize for you to speak to him. He just loves meeting his customers.
Gotta have him on my podcast.
Yeah.
It's a work of art. And then it's, if you know, you know. Like, but if you don't know, the only way that they're going to, you're hear about it, is someone wearing it. And then it's like, somebody notices it and goes, I got to look it up. And then they have the Instagram. And once you go to Instagram, they do a good job on Instagram.
I'm just looking on the Watchbox website. They have one right now.
All right, don't say the price.
They're accepting crypto now.
Oh, so you guys are accepting crypto?
Yes, we've just launched pricing in ETH and Bitcoin.
That's cool.
Yeah, it's crazy the spillover that we've seen recently, where for natural reasons, but you know, a lot of this younger customer demographic are looking to transfer some of their crypto exposure into hard assets. And
this is what I thought would happen. This is a great
Doge
sign.
Kings.
No Doge coins. So do you have to quickly take no risk? You just switch it to a stable coin?
Correct. I mean, we use a third-party payment gateway where they do the conversion.
Oh, are you using BitPay or something else? They're using BitPay?
Yeah, we're using BitPay.
Oh, that's my friend. I got to introduce you to them. Okay. Well, you're staying up on... And then I do like Panerai. Do they hold their value? I just think just as contemporary look, I would say hit or miss is high with me. I just think they're not as comfortable to wear. I will say that. And I think because they were a military watch more than anything to start, I think.
But all right.
Do they hold their value?
They have different models that perform better than others. There's a model called a Bronzo, which does very well. It's very collectible. I mean, the key thing with Panerai is it's a huge dial. It's a 44 millimeter dial, you know, by and large for most of their models. And, you know, in different markets, for example, in Asia, you know, they prefer smaller dials, whereas over here in, you know, the West, you know, the larger dials, you know, definitely perform better. But it's definitely, you know, one of the better brands that Richemont carries that does perform well. You know, it's definitely, you know, people are looking for an alternative to a Rolex or an Omega or a Breitling. You know, Panerai is a really good choice.
What does that say to you, Nikita, if you see me with a large dial? What does that say about the guy? We know. He has a, he probably has a Corvette. Is that what you're going to say next? The so if you're going to open in New York,
I think
the new Corvette. I mean, a lot of people are getting it.
Howard, you should write a book on how to pick up a man. This is just great dating tips.
I know it is weird. I do that. Men know how to pick me up. Like just the watch. Generally, I was a shoe guy for a long time, but I think the watch is the only thing casual that you can wear that makes a statement anymore, right? Like there used to be like Taboot shoes or Ferragamo shoes, but I don't know. I don't dress fancy enough to pull that off on a day-to-day basis. So it really is, I think things are lining up really well for Watchbox. Is there another part of jewelry you would get in as ancillary or no?
Today, there isn't. I mean, we have customers that come through our platform because they trust us. They ask us for, you know, jewelry for their wives or their girlfriends. And, you know, a guy will come in and he'll spend $100,000 on a timepiece and says, okay, I need to buy, he's probably feeling a little guilty. And he says, okay, I need to buy 3-carat studs for my wife. And we'll organize that for him. And it's basically, you know, once you've got trust with this customer, there's other things that he will want to buy from you, whether it be jewelry or other things for his partner. What we also find is that men will buy a pre-owned watch for themselves. They'll never buy a pre-owned watch in general for their spouse, I mean, or their girlfriend. And that's where we've realized that, you know, we have to recognize the product that we're selling, and the customer will buy that. By the same token, you know, in a large part, women don't buy expensive jewelry for themselves. You know, the first purchaser is their partner. So it's a really interesting dynamic when you see how, you know, male and female, you know, purchasing behavior changes around price point. So I think that's where we see, you know, our customer really is on our platform, the male. But having said that, we see a lot of independent women coming in and buying, you know, men's watches for themselves. Because I think that's one thing that if you interview, you know, 100 of our customers, and you ask them the same question that you're asking Nikita, you know, what does she find appealing? Or if a man's wearing a watch, what would you tell? There's a lot of men these days that will say they find it incredibly attractive when a woman wears a men's watch.
I think it's cool. And maybe Apple knew that by doing the different sizes, because you wear the bigger iPhone watch, and I think it's cool. You don't wear the petite face one.
Oh, yeah?
I think that's okay. A bigger one. The like you said, you're accepting money is money, and whatever you can exchange is fine. So Bitcoin, Ethereum, I think it makes sense. So it's very modern the way you're thinking about this. In a world where kids like collecting stuff and don't even have to own it, how do you think about that at Watchbox? Can you share anything around that? Like, you know, fractional ownership and NFTs and stuff, or is it stuff that you're thinking about and can talk about, or how do you see that world? Bringing those people on as collectors that don't own it and can work themselves up to their first Rolex at $6,000 or something.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting topic. I mean, it's got, you know, recently a lot of legs, people looking to try and get into the space of collecting, you know, whether it be through fractional share ownership of a hard asset. And you're seeing that more and more with trading cards, sports memorabilia, you know, what, you know, we're doing at Rally, Masterworks and Otis. You know, there's definitely an opportunity there to do something rather similar with watches. I think some of these platforms actually do this from time to time. But the real opportunity is in where I see something that could change the landscape, especially for watches, is that here you have an industry which has incredible liquidity. You know, there's billions of dollars of watches which are trading through the system each year. And if there's an opportunity where you can take that same liquidity and borrow it and put it into the digital world where you can create digital representations of the watches on an actual basis, you know, I believe that there's going to be a new change where customers, even today, where customers buy watches from us, many of them don't actually collect the watches. They leave them in our vault. And so if we can create a platform using, you know, new technology, blockchain, NFTs, to allow them to, in a frictionless way, collect them in their digital wallet, no different to how you collect digital art in your MetaMask, you know, you can create the opportunity to have a portfolio of watches that you can trade through our platform. So I think there's something, you know, really exciting there. We have a sandbox within Watchbox, which we're building something quite exciting that we're going to be talking about in the coming months. And I think that's something where it could be opening up to a much, much larger demographic, but at the same time, taking the liquidity principles of what we're doing into a digital world, which I think watches is one of the few verticals we can do this as compared to other less liquid markets like art.
Yeah, well, other than cycling and stocks, watches are, I just think, it's great to see this exists. I'm glad I found it. I don't know if I'd be searching for this, and I didn't realize how big a market it really was. But the liquidity is key. The knowledge that I could just swap and not have to carry 50 watches in inventory and feel like that's stressful versus I know they're held at Watchbox and I can borrow or trade at any time. I think the liquidity is the future. So very cool for building this out. I learned a ton. And I'm in New York, so I think I'll hit you up and we'll try and connect soon in person. But thanks for taking the time with us today.
Yeah, it's lovely to catch up again, Howard, and lovely to meet you, Nikita and Knut.
Thank you.
Talk to you soon.
All right, bye, guys.
Bye. So there you have it. Interesting, different take, huh?
Very interesting, yeah.
Guys are way different than women about this.
What a great niche product.
It's not niche, 300 million.
Well, I know, but it's like one product, and it's just beautiful.
It's always been around, and casual world, the Lulu world has actually not cheapened it, which I think there was this moment where it was, and then to the point where Apple comes out and says, fuck it, everybody should just have an Apple Watch, and it's kind of made this stuff more important to me.
Yeah, like he said, the TAM has grown from 3 billion to 20 billion.
Yeah, the TAM's going to be 100 billion.
Yeah.
So very exciting for me. I'm just a cool subject, very guy subject. But
very exciting for me too.
You think? Because that's something that you know now to buy your next boyfriend if he's somebody worthwhile.
Patek Philippe.
I mean, you can't go wrong with a Rolex. You buy a guy a Patek Philippe, they could get mad.
Okay, fine.
Because it's saying something very personal.
That Raisins looked good.
The Raisins is insane. You can't afford it, but yeah. So you were listening to Panic with Friends. That's Knut and Nikita and myself. It hasn't been panic in a while. There was a panic recently in crypto. But anyways, there will be moments of panic. Every week we have entrepreneur, a founder, venture capitalist, a trader. We talk about markets. We talk about new industries and things that fascinate me around trends and momentum and investing. So that was the watchbox.com, Justin, the CEO. If you search Howard Lindzen and podcasts, you will find us on Apple or Spotify or any of your favorite podcast apps. You can subscribe. You'll get one every Thursday. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. We'll see everybody soon.